BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, I'm on a call to Charlie Lewis, a telecoms consultant based in Cape Town. Charlie is a former senior lecturer at the Link Center at the School of Public and Development Management at Wits University, where he lectured for almost 16 years between 2001 and 2016. He's an expert on labor work and ICT, telecoms regulation, universal access, the internet, and ICT policy development. He's undertaken extensive research in a wide range of areas related to ICT. Charlie is intimately familiar with the ICT policy and regulatory environment in South Africa, and among other roles, he has served as a member of the Ministerial ICT Policy Review Panel between 2012 and 2015. A former unionist, he headed IT for Trade Union Federation COSATU between 1994 and 2001. Charlie, thank you for taking time out of your schedule today for what I'm sure is going to be a fascinating discussion about telecoms policy in South Africa.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
It's our pleasure. Before we talk about policy, Charlie, and there's lots to talk about in that area, tell us a bit about yourself. You headed IT for COSATU after the 1994 election, but what is your background?
Well, I mean, I usually used to say to my students, kind of in a nutshell, I'm a kind of former high school teacher, former computer programmer, former trade unionist, and latter-day kind of academic. I guess I would add to that I'm a latter-day consultant. So, you know, I first got involved in ICT many years back when I was teaching in Zimbabwe, actually.
Oh, yes.
Playing around with assembler programming and BBC computers and ZX Spectrums and various other things like that. Spent a number of years computer programming after I came back to South Africa, which is in the late 1980s. And then with the advent of democracy, elected rather than go into parliament or get on the gravy train to go and work for COSATU. So I ran COSATU's IT for some 7 or so years. And after that, I kind of had my arm twisted and found myself in academia, where I researched and taught for the last 15 years. And now I've moved down to Cape Town, trying to build for myself a bit of a career as an ICT consultant, and working to finish off my PhD. That's it pretty much in a nutshell.
Okay. What are you, what's the focus of your PhD?
It's universal access and service in South Africa. So I've been looking at what happened in the last 15, 25 years, you know, from about 1994 onwards, so it's really about 20 years, in terms of what was done about universal access and service. You know, you can see the trade unionist, the social conscience, I guess, coming through in that kind of area of focus. You know, wanting to look and see what was done to try and get telephones, mobile, internet, and I guess now broadband to kind of poor people in remote rural areas. What was attempted, what worked and what didn't work.
Right. Well, let's talk about that because it's a fascinating area and a lot has been attempted in South Africa over the years to try to bridge the so-called digital divide and to get connectivity into the hands of people who historically haven't had it. Now, Charlie, you've been looking at this space for a long time. You'll remember what happened back in the mid-1990s with the partial privatization of Telkom and the conditions that were placed on that partial privatization. Telkom was given a monopoly. I think it was five years, possibly extended to six, in return for rolling out telephone service into underserviced parts of South Africa. Of course, the old apartheid government didn't focus on providing telecommunication services in rural South Africa. And so it was a very big focus of the Nelson Mandela administration and of that Telkom restructuring and sale to try and address that. It didn't really work out, did it? What was the sort of the genesis of that? And where do you think we perhaps went wrong as a country in trying to address the digital divide in those early days?
Look, I mean, yes, if you go back and you look at the history, it's not a very, salubrious tale.
Right.
We tried to do, I think, all the right things, and I think we tried to do the right things for the right reasons. So, I mean, the policy initially was very well motivated. And yes, we put obligations on Telkom in terms of rolling out of lines, payphones, and so on and so forth. We also, and I think we were some of the first in the world to do so, put obligations on the mobile operators in terms of providing community service telephones. There was obviously also geographical coverage requirements. So, you know, things like that were done, and they were considered international best practice, and they're still very widely done today.
Right.
We also set up a universal service fund, got people to pay a levy on their turnover, put it into the fund, and attempted, and that's probably the best word, or the kindest word, to spend it on kind of useful projects. Sadly, that didn't go very well at all. A couple of other things we attempted, you know, that were not best practice, but were considered very important. One of them was the whole creation of a class of rural licenses, the infamous USALF, of whom there were something like 27 or so that got licenses, and as far as I know, there's only one that I'm aware of that's still operational today.
Wow.
And of course, we established the Universal Service Agency as it was originally.
Yes, just to remind.
So we tried to do a lot of good stuff.
Sorry, Charlie, just to remind people listening to the show who perhaps don't remember that era. This was an initiative that Ivy Matsepe Kasaburi came up with when she was minister back in the 1990s to license these so-called underserviced area licensees. They were confined to more rural areas, underserviced areas. Do you think there were, I mean, looking back at it now, I would imagine that the minister at the time had her heart in the right place with this idea, but they were kind of set up to fail, weren't they? They were constrained to only operating in these markets where perhaps it isn't possible to make a profit.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, if you look at each of the areas when they were determined, and there's a whole set of issues. I mean, she determined 27 areas in which licenses were then issued.
Mm.
You know, each of them had a town of some size in them and had low, but it was fixed line tele-density at the time.
Right.
So, you know, there were areas that were potentially viable. I think, you know, if one was to look at it, I think a lot of the problems that happened with the policy was an inability to understand the changing environment, the dynamics of the shifts that were happening in the sector, and to respond to that.
Mm,
mm. You know, so jumping back to the question of the obligations that were placed on Telkom, back in 1994, fixed was the game, and everyone assumed that phones would get to people by means of fixed phones. And so Telkom got these huge kind of rollout obligations placed in it. People didn't recognize, and it was being recognized internationally at the time, that what was happening was people were shifting to mobile.
Yeah.
And in South Africa, particularly with the introduction of prepaid mobile, it suddenly became much more affordable for poor people to have a mobile phone, which they could use for 10, 15 minutes in the course of a month, than to try and get a Telkom phone with all of the kind of long-term obligations and costs that were attached to that. And so the focus was providing access to people through fixed phones. What was happening was the market was shifting across to mobile. And I think the same problem plagued the underserviced area licensees when they got their licenses, mm-hmm. because they got licenses in areas where fixed line teledensity was low, but at precisely the time point in time at which mobile had actually grown to be bigger than fixed in South Africa. So they were essentially competing against the mobile operators more or less with one hand tied behind their backs. And they really, it was like a non-starter from the get-go.
And consumers wanted those mobile services. They preferred them, and the price was right, so the U-cells were effectively dead in the water.
Yeah, if you were a poor person in a rural area in kind of 2000, and you wanted access to a phone, what did you do? You went mobile. You didn't think of Telkom.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so there's only one left, you said. Who is that, as a matter of interest?
Beg your pardon?
Sorry, Charlie. You mentioned that there's only one of these U-cell licensees left. Who is it, as a matter of interest?
Well, they now go under the name of East Tel.
Yeah.
They're based in East London. So they were one of the original seven and the only one to have survived today. And they are still going.
Wow, wow. Be interesting to have a chat to them and find out what they've done differently.
They're effectively an ISP now.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's, you know, the center of gravity of the market has kind of shifted quite dramatically over that period, you know, from being predominantly fixed in about 93, 94, to being mobile, and then the shift going on towards internet and now towards broadband and fiber-enabled broadband.
Mm. It raises an interesting question, Charlie, because governments had these policies, and today they're again talking about interventions in the market to deliver broadband services to the whole country. We've got the government's broadband plan. We've got a lot of talk about this in the ICT policy white paper. A lot of talk about government intervening in the sector to ensure that there's universal broadband. But what we've seen on the voice side is that you can make a telephone call from just about anywhere in this country now. The mobile operators talk about having over 99% population coverage with their networks.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the penetration of SIM cards in South Africa is incredibly high. It's probably not quite universal, although if you look at the actual SIM card numbers, it's probably sitting at 160 or 170% of the population now. We're in kind of a similar position now again, where we're talking about, it's not voice as it was in the 90s, we're talking about broadband. Will the market not simply sort itself out? Do we need the government to be intervening? We saw how mobile brought universal voice service to South Africans. Is there a need for intervention, or will the market simply provide these services down the line because they'll provide service to meet consumer demand?
You know, I think there's some merit in the argument that the market will provide, but it's going to be a trickle-down provision that's going to happen.
Mm.
You know, and you can see it today now. In my mind, there's a new and very kind of serious digital divide going on.
Mm.
You drive through kind of the suburbs of Joburg, and all over the place, you see these rolls of kind of orange cable and blue cable as people kind of trench fiber all over the show. But where is it happening? You know, it's happening in the cities.
Mm.
And it's happening predominantly in the affluent areas of the cities. There are obviously costs and economies of scale out in rural areas. And so I don't think that you're going to see fiber to the home. You're certainly not going to see fiber to the home in rural villages in South Africa in anything like the foreseeable future. I mean,
sure.
The costs are prohibitive. The returns on investment are almost null. And so any company that would undertake that with its own bet would be committing commercial suicide.
Mm.
On the other hand, it's vitally important that we make sure that people in those kind of rural areas and in remote communities do get access to the benefits of the internet, the access to information, the facilities of communication, the access to culture, communication, all of those kind of things need to be brought to rural areas to enrich communities, to make life in the rural area sustainable and to kind of arrest the kind of urban drift that takes place. So it's got to be done.
Yeah.
The question really is, how do you do it?
Right.
What sort of incentives, what sort of sources of funding do you put in place to try and make it commercially viable with incentives for operators to actually go there and provide services?
Right, right. I mean, certainly we saw in the voice market that it was those urban wealthy consumers who were serviced first, and that there was the trickle-down effect over time. I suppose that there's a lot of pressure. Politicians want the whole country to be served as quickly as possible. But is there perhaps an argument to be made that this is just the natural order of things in telecommunications or any other service for that matter, that it is the wealthy, it is the cities that get served first, and then there is later a trickle-down. Once there's a mass market that's developed, there's a trickle-down into those rural areas and those people get serviced as well? Or is that politically untenable in the South African context?
Yeah, I think it's politically untenable. I think from a social justice point of view, it's untenable. You know, I mean, a capitalist economy, yes, will work in that kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't simply sit back and fold our arms and say, well, we're stuck in a capitalist economy. Let's kind of let things happen the way they're going to happen. You know, we always make sure, for example, that education is, that everybody in the country has access to education. And that involves taxing the wealthy and channeling those funds to poorer schools. So the same thing needs to take place in the ICT arena to make sure that those underserviced, marginalized individuals, communities, areas are reached and assisted to connect.
Okay.
You know, otherwise, you just stand back and fold your arms and say, "Well, that's the natural order of the universe, and we're not going to do anything about it."
So, you've done a lot of research in this area, as you mentioned. You're doing a doctoral research on universal access. Many countries have tried different things over the years. Is there an example that we can borrow from somewhere else in the world where they've done it really successfully, where they've delivered either voice or now broadband services to the bulk of their population in an affordable way? I know we're experimenting with a lot of ideas in the new ICT policy white paper, but should we not just be borrowing from another market that's done it really well?
That's a difficult question. I mean, most of the markets that have done it, you know, that come out exceptionally well, are rich economies,
mm-hmm.
often geographically much smaller than us. You know, and take, for example, Korea, you know, with much higher population densities. And so the challenges and the issues are very different there. I certainly couldn't point to one particular success story around the world that I would say go out and kind of imitate. And I don't think that you can actually simply imitate. You can look at what seems to be working in particular environments or particular jurisdictions and try and identify what's making that work, what it is about that particular context that makes a particular intervention successful, and then see whether or not that's applicable to South Africa and make the necessary adjustments to make it work in our environment. Not everything that works, something that works in Korea, for example, is not necessarily going to work here.
Let's look at what government's planning to do now. Now, this white paper that was, I think it was around September, October last year that it was published. It's caused a huge amount of controversy, particularly around elements related to spectrum and the wholesale open access network. This plan to create an open access network owned by all the operators that are interested in participating. And that this network will then hold, well, initially the proposal was all future high demand spectrum or spectrum that can be used for wireless broadband. There's been some softening in government's approach on that in recent months. But what is your, you've obviously had a look at the white paper, you've had a look at this wholesale open access network that is being proposed. Charlie, what are your thoughts on what government's trying to do here? Are we setting this up to fail, or do you think there's a real possibility that that a wholesale open access network is in fact the right model to address universal access issues?
You know, I think there's a division of opinion on some of my colleagues I know, or some of the people I interact with I know, would suggest that the WOAN Wireless Open Access Network is in fact a likely vehicle and does in fact enjoy possibilities of success and would be something that's very useful for ISPs to provide access to their clients via. So there, I know that there is a school of thought there. My own kind of concern about the Wireless Open Access Network is that we may simply be repeating the sorry broadband InfraCo saga, that we may be creating an entity that's really not going to succeed. Or that we may, and that would be another concern that I would have, is that we may be creating an entity which, I'm not sure how one would put it, but it's open for exploitation by those who can get on the inside. So if it goes out to tender, who wins the tender? And how much money is at stake? And how much state funding will go into the Wireless Open Access Network? So if you can land up being the successful bidder to operate the Wireless Open Access Network, the WOAN, you might stand to make a lot of money. So I'm concerned that there are commercial opportunities and possibly, potentially corrupt commercial opportunities around the world. I'm concerned that we're creating another state-owned entity that is likely to fail, as we have seen in the case of Broadband InfraCo, and it will simply drain a lot of money. You know, there are a couple of instances around the world where something similar has been attempted, but none that I'm aware of that's been successful. You know, Australia, for example, set to construct a national broadband infrastructure, and it's been extraordinarily costly for them.
Yes.
I don't think the indications are that it's not good international practice to follow.
Yes, yes. I mean, we've certainly seen so many examples of government attempting to intervene in the telecommunications market and it not working. The UCells was an example. I think Ivy Matsepe-Kasaburi also attempted to reposition Centec as a consumer broadband player that also failed to take off.
Why useless?
Yes. Of course, Alec Irwin tried to set up Broadband InfraCo in competition with Telkom in wholesale infrastructure. There've been a whole list of attempts by government to intervene in the market, to bring down prices, et cetera, et cetera. And none of them that I'm aware of have been particularly successful. Is there a way that government could create an environment in which the free market, perhaps through competition, can deliver services to underserviced parts of the country? Is there a policy that would make sense to allow, because we've seen how successful the mobile operators have been in delivering services universally in South Africa. I mean, we can have a discussion about how much those services cost, but they've certainly provided the infrastructure and you can get a cell phone signal just about anywhere in South Africa where you happen to be. Is there perhaps a way to utilize the private sector players to achieve the outcome that the government wants, namely universal broadband services? Or do you think that there needs to be more direct government intervention in the market to ensure that poor people do have internet access?
The trouble with kind of government-led intervention is we'd be backing a particular horse. And if you back the right horse, that's fine. If you back the wrong horse, you could land yourselves in all sorts of trouble. Mm. You also, in my mind, don't want to create an environment where there is a single source of supply, a single set of infrastructure, because then you create the potential for a single point of failure. Mm. That doesn't mean that you simply kind of like sit back, fold your arms, and let the private sector go at it alone. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to intervene and make regulatory interventions to make sure that the way in which the market plays itself out is directed towards the public interest. And that's the public interest of, what's it now, 59 million of us? That needs to be served, and that includes the people in remote and rural communities. And one does that by employing certain kind of regulatory tools. So, for example, I'm very much in favor of the principle of open access. You know, so there could be regulatory interventions to make sure that rival operators are granted open access to the networks of other operators. Mm. Obviously, subject to commercial arrangement, fair pricing, etc., etc. You know, and you have those things already in place in terms of the interconnection. You know,
yes.
A large operator does not want of its own accord to interconnect with a smaller operator, so we force them to do so. We put in place a set of rules by which the rates and the terms of the interconnection are agreed. And so one could do something similar in relation to broadband infrastructure and broadband networks. You know, enforce the principle of open access subject to commercial agreement and a commercial arrangement that can be managed by the regulator. You know, and I think there have been some successes in that area. You know, you alluded to the whole question of pricing. You know, whatever we have to say about ICASA and ICASA's failures in various areas, I think we do have to say that the mobile termination rate intervention has in the end been extremely successful.
Yes.
It has succeeded in bringing down pricing, and there's lots of research to show that prices of telephony and calls have fallen fairly substantially over the years since those interventions kicked in.
Indeed.
So that's been a very successful regulatory intervention. Unfortunately, it's very slow and it's very cumbersome, and so, you know, ICASA is now stuttering into the process of doing the same thing in relation to data. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a cumbersome process. It can take a long time to run. But if they are able to intervene and enforce pro-competitive measures in relation to data, I think we are going to see data costs fall quite dramatically.
Mm. I know my friend Arthur Goldstuck often talks on this issue. He says that it's an unfair situation in South Africa in that the poor end up paying more for data than the rich do, because the rich can afford to buy large data bundles and have an effective lower in bundle per megabyte rate, whereas it's the poor people who are the ones who are actually exposed more to the out-of-bundle rates and who can only afford to buy the smaller bundles, so they're paying a higher effective per megabyte rate for their bundles. Is that something that ICASA should be looking at, in your view, the whole cost of bundles and out-of-bundle pricing? Certainly on the voice side of things, it was a regulatory intervention in a wholesale tariff that was between operators. Should we be considering, should ICASA be considering looking at some sort of regulation around retail prices, specifically when it comes to things like in-bundle and out-of-bundle per megabyte rates? Or do you think that sort of retail price regulation has the potential to do damage to the market?
Look, it really depends ultimately on what the cost of delivery of the data is. And I mean, I think that's what the lesson from the mobile termination intervention has been.
Mm.
is that the cost of delivering termination on the call, is actually far, far lower than the operators would have us believe. You know, and of course it's in their interests to keep the prices as high as possible. They've got, you know, as possible. They've got a share price to maintain. They've got shareholders to keep happy. So, you know, they're not going to cut the prices dramatically overnight unless they're in a situation where they're forced to because everyone else is doing the same thing. So, yes, I think it is correct that we need to intervene. I think Arthur's absolutely correct. You know, the cost of data, really, if you, you know, the cost per megabyte is prohibitively expensive at the smaller the bundle you buy.
Yes.
And who's buying the small bundles? Poor people. Prepaid users.
Is it something, though, that should be addressed at a regulatory level or at a policy level? Does if there's a view that prices are too high, say the out-of-bundle price is too high, or those low-end-of-the-market bundles are priced excessively, if that's the view that's reached, is the solution to then look at regulating those tariffs by the regulator, or is the solution to look at it from a policy perspective and say, actually, the policy's failed? If the prices are too high, it means there's not enough competition in the market, and therefore we need to make an amendment to policy to make the market more competitive to drive down those prices. What is the right approach? Do you use the regulatory stick or the policy carrot?
Well, no, policy is a carrot. I think you have to tackle it at both levels, you know, because you have to be looking at your policies. You have to be looking at the evidence, and that's why the whole argument for evidence-based policy approaches. So we have a particular policy, what's happening, what's the effect on the market, and there's a range of what's the effect on society, and there are a range of things that you would need to look at, and you need to identify things where there are bottlenecks, things where it's best to stand back and leave well alone for the moment, but obviously try and keep your finger on the pulse. So you can set policies, and a policy would be, for example, to say that there should be regulatory intervention where necessary in respect of pricing. So that's the policy side of things. The policy might be related to competition. That, you know, they're not necessarily correlated one-on-one. So you would need to look at what the policies need to be put in place. But the policy would entail giving a regulatory institutions, the regulator, the ability to intervene where necessary, and obviously you have to examine what's happening, the state of the market, the state of competition, the level of pricing, all of those kind of things, intervene in order to address market failure.
Something the white paper looks at as well is the whole issue of local loop unbundling. I know this has been a contentious issue in the South African market for many years. ICASA has threatened to look at it for the longest period. Telkom has always said absolutely mustn't happen. But the white paper, and it's not something that I think the market's really looked at in any detail because I think they've been focused on this WOAN and the spectrum issue. But the white paper also takes quite a hard line on local loop unbundling, saying that it must happen, that it's key to competition in the ICT space in South Africa. Do you think that that horse is bolted, or do you think that LLU still has a place in the South African policy environment?
I'm inclined to think that that horse is bolted, you know. Certainly kind of local loop unbundling in relation to kind of voice, you know, in South Africa, with the kind of environment that you've got and the high proportion of prepaid SIMs that are out there in the market, you know, the shifts happen anyway. I think local loop unbundling in our particular market, I wouldn't say that we shouldn't do it, but I certainly wouldn't say it's a major area of emphasis and intervention, personally.
Okay. I'm going to put you a bit on the spot here, Charlie. I hope you don't mind. I'm going to ask you, if you were the Minister of Telecommunications and Postal Services, looking at the industry as it stands now, looking at the pressure on the price of data to come down particularly, but also, you know, just the broad state of competition in the telecoms and ICT industry more broadly, What would be the top three things you would do in your first months in office as minister? What would be most important in your view to tackling the issues that you, as you see them in the ICT sector in South Africa?
Well, I guess if I were the minister, the first thing I would lobby for is to have my job abolished, actually, along with the Minister of Communications. The crazy, crazy move that we made a couple of years ago for kind of what can only be kind of political considerations rather than the benefit of the sector as a whole, to split the ministries into two. Mm. So, I mean, if I was to intervene in the sector now, the first thing I would do is bring back the single Ministry of Communications that covers the whole broad area of the sector. I think that's absolutely critical, number one. Number two, I guess I would turn back this crazy notion of splitting the regulator back into SATRA and the IBA, which is essentially what the white paper is proposing. It's crazy. Mm. And it's surprising to me that there has been so little kind of outcry about that. You know, you need a single integrated regulator to deal with a market that is converged already, mm-hmm. and increasingly converging, a market where what we're dealing with is a very complex ecosystem of kind of interrelated areas, interrelated services, interrelated technologies. And so it seems to me that it's crazy to try and split the regulator back up into an IBA and a SATRA, which is essentially what is being proposed. And I'm actually, frankly, quite shocked that there has been so little outcry from the industry in that particular area and particular notion. You know, their focus has been, I'm sorry to say, quite self-serving in that they've addressed the spectrum. And the whole outcry and the fight between the minister and the operators and the resolution that's been agreed deals with spectrum doesn't address any of the other problems and issues in the white paper.
You're right. There's a lot.
So I think that
there's a lot in that white paper which hasn't been interrogated in any sort of detail.
Yeah. It's so much of the focus has been on spectrum. And yes, of course, Vodacom and MTN have lots of reasons to be upset about spectrum, but there's lots of else. And if they land up with two regulators, I think we're going to have problems in the sector going forward. I really do. So I think that's another area that needs to be dealt with. Third area that I would think is kind of key in relation to the white paper is the notion of regulatory independence. You know, as a minister, if you look at the white paper, you'll see there are a lot of things that have been clawed back into the ministry. A lot of kind of decision-making competencies that used to reside with the regulator. I'll give you one example, the National Ban Plan, for example, is now being pulled back into the ministry. And so there's a kind of distrust that underpins or runs through the white paper, distrust of the institutions that we have created and their ability to carry out what we've asked them to do. So I think it's vitally important that regulatory independence in all its aspects is kind of adhered to, strengthened, supported in the environment. You know, as a minister, your job is to issue policy. As parliament, your job is to pass legislation. And those are both kind of slow, long-term stuff. You create a regulator that's there on the ground with the expertise, with the knowledge, with the skills to respond dynamically to the environment. And yes, to interact back with you as a ministry and advise you where policy needs to be changed, consult with you on policy issues. Yes, that has to happen. But I think regulatory independence is a key issue that needs to be addressed. And going on with that, or relating to that, is making sure that ICASA is assisted, supported into becoming actually an effective regulator. You know, with competence, resources, skills, the kinds of things that you see in regulatory entities like Ofcom, for example. you know, the ability to actually respond dynamically, effectively in the market.
Do you think that the government keeps ICASA deliberately weak? I mean, we've seen that where government wants a strong regulator, it can create one. And we just have to look at the competition authorities, for example. South Africa's competition authorities are well resourced, appear to be quite effective, and they have the budget to do what they need to do. ICASA, on the other hand, is constantly complaining it's underfunded. It's clear it doesn't have the wide range of skills it requires. It very often doesn't have a full complement of counselors. Do you think that? What do you think? I'm sorry, say that again.
It's clogged with dead wood in the staff.
What is the reason for this? Is it a deliberate attempt by the government to keep ICASA weak? And if so, why?
You know, you asking me to kind of like mind read here. I don't know if there's a deliberate attempt necessarily to keep ICASA weak and ineffectual. Mm. What I do think is there's a worry and a mistrust that ICASA will make decisions, regulatory interventions that the ministry may disapprove of.
Right.
I think that's where a lot of it stems from, you know. But if the legislation is good and strong and enabling, if the regulatory body is well resourced, with high quality leadership at the top, competent staff at the bottom, you may not agree with every decision that it takes. And God forbid that you should, in any event.
Yes.
You may not agree with every decision that it takes, but you need to, you know, you will have decisions that are well thought out, rational, reasonable interventions. And that's the whole point of having a regulator. Mm. You know, you can't be second-guessing the regulator all the time. You have to trust them. And sometimes they will do things that you don't agree with. And that's the name of the game.
Which they've done. I mean, the minister is now suing ICASA over the planned spectrum auction. They're still pushing ahead with that. It seems ICASA has grown some teeth in the last little while. But
it seems that
ICASA has grown some teeth in that they are, in the past they've always seen perhaps as being a bit of a lapdog of the politicians, but they're not rolling over on the spectrum auction issue.
Well, I think they, you know, after sitting on their kind of hands for how many years when they withdrew the initial plan to deal with high demand spectrum,
yes,
and then finally kind of getting their act into gear. Sadly, of course, they did it just as the minister was preparing to issue the white paper and hand all the spectrum over to the WOAN. So
yes.
That's where we had that particular little bun fight.
Right.
Look, I mean, the courts have ruled on that. It's going to be interesting to see where that goes. It's an interesting fight.
And the other challenge, of course, Charlie, and you mentioned it, was the fact that the department's been split in two and that ICASA, in effect, now reports to the Minister of Communications, Ayanda Dlodlo, whereas a lot of the work it actually does is related to the work of the Department of Telecommunications.
Precisely. And that was just simply because people didn't want to go and change the legislation. And so, you know, we had Minister of Communications written on the legislation, so we stick with that.
Yes. Yes. Let's talk a bit about digital TV, which really has been a mess for many years now. I think Ivy Matsepe-Kasaburi back in the late 1990s, or even the mid-1990s, set a deadline of... No, I think she set it a bit later than that. But she certainly set the deadline for around 2011, I think it was. December 2011 was the original deadline. We missed that deadline, subsequent deadlines. We then missed the international telecommunications deadline of June 2015. We're now sitting in late 2017, and this process is still going on. The broadcasters are still using the digital dividend spectrum that the mobile operators need to provide broadband. Charlie, what's, and I know this is a very broad question, but what really has gone wrong here?
I all sorts of things, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there have been some to-ing and fro-ing in terms of policy and the desire, and I think once again you see it as the desire of the ministry to actually call the shots and make the decisions rather than let the things actually be dealt with at arm's length by the regulator. So I think that's some of the problem. You know, we have the whole kind of to and fro at one point in terms of what standard we were going to adopt in digital TV. And then the fight in recent years over whether or not there should be encryption in the set-top boxes, you know, which has kind of seesawed its way through the courts.
Yes.
I mean, we've had all sorts of kind of delays that have held up the process.
It's not just one thing, and it's happened over a series of many ministers. The encryption issue is the one that really seems to have held up the whole process, though, being dragged in and out of court. The Constitutional Court, of course, pronounced on this recently, and we're now waiting to hear what the new Communications Minister, Ayanda Dlodlo, is going to, or her position on it and where the process is going to go. She's been rather quiet since a consultation, I think, about a month ago with the broadcasters. I suppose she's considering all of the issues. But we're very late in the process. How do you think this whole thing should unfold now? I mean, where do you fall, first of all, on the encryption debate? And what do we need to do to get this process speeded up? Because it's clear the operators need access to the spectrum quite urgently.
And I mean, it's the access to the spectrum is not going to happen quickly, no matter how fast we proceed with the digital migration. I mean, you know, you've got to go through switch off, you've got to go through restacking. There's a whole process. So it's going to be a number of years before that spectrum is available. You know, I think some of the problems here kind of relate to very kind of powerful commercial interests at stake. And I've always been in favor of making or producing set-top boxes that at least have the ability to have an encrypted slot. So I'm kind of, in a sense, putting my stake in the ground there. You know, given the fact that we've got a market which is effectively a pay TV monopoly market, and that the set-top box rollout, you know, offers the potential for allowing that market to be diversified. And I think we missed that option. I think Yunus Karim's solution was going to take us in that direction.
Right.
But of course, that was very short-lived, and now we kind of, my understanding is that we're effectively back where Yunus had us a couple of years ago.
So I suppose we really need to wait to see what Ayanda Dlodlo says about the whole issue before we can move forward.
But the problem is, while this is all going on, I mean, the market's marching ahead.
Yes.
You know, and my concern is that where we're sitting now with the kind of digital environment, you know, you're sitting with a situation where effectively, I think it's around about 50% of the population, I have to check the exact figures, actually has digital television already, but they're getting it through satellite. And so the digital migration, my worry is only going to be set-top boxes to poor households, and that we may simply land up with a new television apartheid, where all the rich, affluent houses will have satellite dishes parked outside them, watching the kind of plethora of channels that are coming down via satellite, and the poor people, poor households, will be watching digital terrestrial TV. You know, and I know where the advertising spend is going to go. It's going to go on the satellite. It's not going to go on the terrestrial stuff. And what that's going to mean is that the rich content is going to be on satellite, not going to be on terrestrial. So I'm really quite concerned that because of the delays, we're going to land up with a two-tier market in digital television.
Just to play devil's advocate for a moment there, isn't that the case all over the world, though? Isn't terrestrial always a poor second cousin to a pay-for service? I mean, if you go to the UK or the US, you get terrestrial free-to-air services. But if you want high-end content, you have to subscribe to, say, HBO in the US or one of the cable channels. Or if you're in the UK, you have to subscribe to BSkyB or one of the premium operators there. Isn't there an argument to be made that if you want free television, you're not going to get the best content?
Yes, to an extent that's true. That is true. But, you know, if you look in South Africa, what's the most widely watched TV channel in South Africa?
SABC One.
It's a free-to-air channel. Mm. Well, I'd have to look at the audience figures, but I think you'd probably find 1, 2, 3, 4 are all free-to-air channels.
Probably.
Most widely watched channels in South Africa. And, you know, there are a lot of success stories with public service television worldwide.
Mm.
Yes, you're not going to get the kind of premium content that you get on subscription stuff. So that's inevitable, but there's no reason why you shouldn't have subscription terrestrial as well as subscription satellite.
Mm. Mm. It's an interesting argument. I mean, the UK has fantastic terrestrial television, but then you're required to pay a very high license fee to the BBC for that content. If you've got a TV, you're expected to pay, I think it's £140 or £150 a year. Or is it even a month? I forget the details, but it's certainly not cheap. The SABC in South Africa, I think a TV license is about 265 rand a month last time I checked. Producing good quality content is certainly not cheap. So it's ETV's made the argument that without encryption we can't.
But that's why we have public broadcasting, and that's why we consider public broadcasting a public service good.
Subsidized.
And we are prepared to put taxpayers' money and tax people in order to provide public service broadcasting, because that's what the BBC license fee is. It's not a license to watch BBC. It's a tax levied on everybody with a television to make sure that the BBC can provide the kind of quality and range of content that we consider or they consider to be in the public interest.
Indeed. Great. Charlie, thank you so much for your time on the podcast today. Charlie Lewis is a telecoms sector consultant based in Cape Town. Charlie, if anyone listening to this podcast wants to get hold of you, what's the best way? Do you have a Twitter handle or a website?
Well, probably the easiest is to give you my email address, which is charlie.a.lewis@gmail.com. And otherwise, you will also find me around on Facebook. I do have a Facebook site where I post kind of comments and stories from time to time. So yes, I'd be happy to hear from anybody who wants to get in touch with me. Fight with some of my more outrageous statements and interact with me on some of the more sane and sensible ones, which I hope they were in between.
Great stuff. Well, Charlie, thanks so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast today. I know this is an area that we could probably spend the entire day, in fact, the entire week talking about. But we've touched on some of the key issues and perhaps looked back at some of the more interesting aspects of what's happened in the policy and regulatory environment in the sector over the last 10 or 20 years. And I'd love to have you on the show again at some point in the future. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much, Duncan. It's been an absolute pleasure.